Chapter 8. Lonely Nights. Solitude was scarcely a breath away through March and April, in spite of the novelty of my being in unfamiliar territory with a unique assignment. A census was proclaimed for Australia later in the year, but Wilmer Ingalls' numbers were likely not to exceed the 6 white adults who live there now, and they might still be reduced by 1 teacher. Bunny had Dorothy, Eric Matheson and the 2 jackaroos had each other, and I was alone. Each day after the cows were milked and I had eaten porridge and helped the Horville children find matching socks from an ever-present pile of laundry, I wandered over to the little schoolhouse with lessons prepared from the night before, taught and returned for a light salad or cheese and tomato sandwich lunch. After school, I played rugby with the Aboriginal children who, like myself, had no need to rush home. The telephone exchange consumed some of the evening time, as did marking schoolwork and planning for the next day. When the lights were doused at 10 o'clock and the generator switched on to recharge for the coming day, I retired with my thoughts to the cot on the back veranda. I had some long talks with myself. Was this a life? Beyond the humdrum of Wilmer Ingalls, the world was abuzz with remarkable events. Russian space probes from the launching of the 5th Sputnik in February were finally being challenged by the United States as Major Robert White took an X-15 on a 9-minute test flight. As well as a space chase, the 2 major powers were headed for serious confrontation over Cuban exiles and Fidel Castro's communism. Israeli agents had captured murderer Adolf Eichmann in Argentina, and his trial of the century was about to begin in Jerusalem. While these powerful events unfolded half a world away, Australians debated the costs of a proposed opera house at Bennelong Point, which Joseph Cole, Labour Premier, was convinced could be built for £3.5 million. Bunny faithfully listened to the ABC news at midday and digested every morsel from papers that came in on the Tuesday and Saturday mail trucks. Prime for argument, he would subject me to analysis of each crisis, and since my intellect remained sadly inferior to his brilliance, he retained his grip as mentor while I remained a suitable listener. He also influenced others, assuring himself of his place along the Colgo. So determined was he to retain the upper hand, he would check an article in the National Geographic before going off, perchance to discuss a topic, even with a supposed authority. However he contrived to gain the intellectual upper hand, no one could really rival him in his capacity to gather, process, and mentally retrieve information. If politics, economics, history, and geography were at Bunny's command, so too was the genealogy of the Wilmer Ingalls Aboriginals. He could recount the ancestry of every individual as easy as a punter traced the breeding of racehorses. The Aboriginals confided in him because his had proved to be a more accurate account of the tribal heritage than that of the aging Robin Campbell. One night, after Dorothy and the children were in bed, I asked Bunny how he'd come to gain this confidence. Granny Bailey was the matriarch of the group, he said expansively, putting aside the newspaper. I buried her 4 years ago, in 1957, just after a big rain. I had to float the coffin across the river. I was the last person without a license to officially bury anybody, and my job as postmaster gave me the authority to do so. I've buried 9 altogether, so help me God. And not one body was seen by a medical officer or policeman. Old Granny Bailey must have been 104 years old. I learned a lot from her. When she died, there was no one to take her place. Oh, so people started talking to you. My boy, I drive a lot of them to town and out to work on the stations. The gins, the women, especially like to tell me things. Do they fancy you? Don't be cute. This is not the place to speak of such things. Bunny never spoke about sexual exploits with me. I suppose he'd have been a fool to confide in anyone who couldn't match bragging innuendo. Vanity over his intelligence superseding any other conceit meant Bunny didn't have to resort to smut, but he was astute enough to alter his thoughts in midstream if it meant keeping an audience. "People tell me things," he repeated. Take the new kid in school today, sired by the Angonia schoolteacher out of a full blood. Now, the teacher wouldn't want that to be common knowledge. And don't you start getting any ideas. Some gems might tempt you to mess with them, but you'll be well advised to leave them alone. I've seen the way you lust after Big Beatrice when she comes to the store. You think she doesn't feel your eyes all over her body? Oh, she's just bursting out of that little blouse. I guess she can't even get it together at the front, and the way she wiggles her ass. Ah, forget it. We don't do that out here anymore, Bunny said. When did you stop? I said. I've seen the way the jackaroos look at Beatrice. I've seen the way Beatrice looks at them. You can't tell me they're not having a little bit at night. There's not a single white woman within 100 miles of here. Downriver at Coringle, Elaine Thompson had introduced me to a governess who had painted large white circles around her eyes because she thought her nose was too big. Fascinating. But Beatrice made a point of walking up to the store every day, and though I fought against watching her, her swiveling hips and half-exposed breasts drew me like a sandfly to a choice cut, and she would turn her head swiftly and give me a big smile, happy to see me squirm with embarrassment. Bunny intruded on my thoughts. They're out there, trust me, and don't knock the jackaroos. They'd be dismissed quick smart if they were caught messing with the camp girls. You need a car to get away. I don't know how you can just accept doing nothing week in and week out. Well, I can only go where I'm invited. I was saving for a down payment on a car, but I couldn't bring myself to impose on people for a ride somewhere. I hated asking for anything. Bunny, little caring for my social well-being, continued. Philip Eulow's auntie brought him to Wilmeringle. They live with Darcy Shillingsworth, a very aggressive man. They're not as brutal as his brother Hogan. Hogan will fight over who gets the last chop at a barbecue. And when he has a few drinks, he's only one wish. Kill a white man. The worst day's work I ever did was to save his miserable life. Hogan, I mused, remembering the evil finger-pointer from my first day in town. It was unnerving to hear this man live locally. Strange I hadn't seen him. The telephone exchange reverberated through the front of the home. Bunny remained composed in his easy chair. Someone phoning Bullabalaley, I said, deciphering the code. I'll get it. I put through a call from Alan Thompson to Edgar Fessy. Tough man, that Hogan, Bunny picked up when I returned. Someone hit him with a sulky axle once, put a dent in his skull, 2 inches deep. I offered to drive him to the doctor, but he wouldn't go. Next morning he said he had a headache. I reckon he had. Dot drove him to Brewarrina. Now there's another story. The car got a flat tire, and Hogan said he'd walk the remaining 50 miles. Dot wouldn't hear of it and sent one of Hogan's boys off. A car came along, and the kid lay down in the middle of the road because he knew no one would stop for a black boy, and they didn't. They drove right around the poor little bugger. Dot jumped out and stopped them, and they changed the tire. Yeah, Hogan owes me, but he's forgotten by now. He doesn't say much, but you can feel the hate in his black heart. You've got Hogan, Darcy, and Ben Shillingsworth, Ruby's brothers, all as close to full bloods as you're going to get. And same goes for Robin Campbell, who sometimes calls himself Robin Quartpot. And then there's Jack O'Lantern, Toddy and Emma and Bob and Colin Bailey, all part of the Murawari tribe. Robin Campbell seems friendly enough. What makes Hogan so angry? Booze. Too many nights in jail. The whack on the head. I've heard he'd love to get his hands on you for some reason, so be on your guard. The exchange rang again, and Bunny struggled out of the vinyl armchair to attend to it. I didn't dwell on Hogan. I had school program outlines strewn all over the kitchen table, and as intriguing as Bunny's babblings were, I had work to do. Teaching at Wilmeringle was a real challenge, with student ages ranging from 5 to 15, and actual schooling experiences so varied. Preparing for these differences required an inordinate amount of time. The shortage of books and pencils and general supplies tested my patience. A lot of singing and playing took place during the day, but the children enjoyed singing and playing. Fundamental skills were not overlooked. In the shade of the bowshed or in the smelly confines of the classroom, those students who didn't drift off to sleep scratched numerals and letters on their desks or in the sand with their fingers. Fingered sand tracks formed solar systems and map symbols and illustrated nutritional foods and the life cycle of grasshoppers. In the air and on each other's backs and feet, students traced letters and numerals with dexterity. Doug Brown and Roy Barker showed talent as artists. Stanley Hooper still reversed the E in his name, Stanley, but All the letters were in order, even though the print was large and ungainly. Shirley Wallace and Margaret Orchard were becoming competent assistants. Bernard Horvill and Robin Davis competed with every exercise, Bernard using his fingers a lot to emphasise his points the way his father did. Leo Horvill, by some miracle, it was hard to believe my phonics instruction made that much difference, was reading magazines at home. Dougie Orchard followed all direction with the gravest intensity, and if he reaped any pleasure from what he did, it was hard to say. When copying letters, his fingers clutched the chalk so tightly that his palms filled with powder. Yet the inevitable appearance of a word on the blackboard, written in his own hand, brought an inner satisfaction he sometimes found hard to conceal. Arms folded, brow knitted, he would stand back to view his effort, oblivious to all, and sometimes look as though his tight lips might smile. But that was too much to ask for. Primitive though it was, looking like a large garden shed, though I'd learned the teacher over in Ingonia taught in an abandoned railway carriage, real differences from other places of learning existed. No monitor was needed to collect exercise books or to make ink or sharpen pencils. No one read monthly magazines, as they never arrived. No one needed to be excused for a drink, as there was no water. We took no pledge under a non-existent flag. Every Monday, Len Davis brought a few gallons of drinking water from his own scant supply at Burbar and siphoned it into a 50-gallon tank, which had been installed under the school's downspout. The children were cautioned to use this water sparingly and were forever tapping the rungs on the little tank to be aware of the diminishing amount. The tank was usually empty by Wednesday, and everyone suffered their thirst privately through the remainder of the week. Len had also wired an old cowbell to the eucalyptus sapling alongside the school, and this furthered the precept that time segments were a major part of formal education. Aboriginals had good knowledge of time, since they had always attended to seasonal pursuits and nominated events in terms of moon phases and the position and movement of the stars. But the students adopted my time game obligingly. The bell hung like a tree ornament, and the children pleaded for turns to belt it with a pipe, since its hollow carol set everyone in motion, calling them to and from class. Summoned from games of tag and jacks, from harassing fat Stanley Hooper, or from spying on each other in the little toilet, whose hessian walls lifted with the slightest breeze, the students assembled in formation on the playground, tallest to shortest, at one-arm intervals, in rows. Like a ragtag collection of recruits, they stood at ease, hands behind backs, undaunted by the flies, squinting into the blinding sun and trying not to lift their bare feet off the burning sand. Weekly sets of lesson plans were tantamount to my survival as a teacher. They helped me obtain order and purpose. That the students showed a desire to learn was a blessing. The Department of Education's curriculum had been designed for more idyllic situations, but I adhered to the core subjects and prayed that more texts, reading materials, and other paper supplies would soon arrive. In the interval, I would continue to trust my intuition. Dorothy Horvill and I played a game before every mail truck arrival, trying to second-guess deliveries to the school. Library books, she would state, and I would respond, "What a treat. Where would we put them?" I say globes, 10 of them. "Ink powder, watercolours," Dorothy would laugh. "Anything that requires mixing with water." Yet lack of resources aside, I was compelled to make every child literate. I was their champion. I hoped I would not fail them. Bunny returned from the telephone. "The Gadigal operator wants to talk with you." "Who's on tonight, Nellie or Samantha?" "Sam." Sam Gibbs had a delightful laugh, and, according to one of the locals, nipples that would be the envy of a Jersey cow. Rumour had it that a jackaroo was making out with her, but I had never known them to leave Wilmer Ingle. They were always working. Once in a while, one would stop by the school for a visit, too brief to bother dismounting for, and he'd comment on the drought, the growing number of wild pigs, and occasionally drop a choice tidbit about the girls on the Gadigal exchange. This latter fell with delight on my ears. The telephone exchange had become an interesting companion. I welcomed the staccato that called me to the old amber box with its row of black switches that could put me in touch with the outside world. I honed my interest in weather forecasts and sympathised when graziers spoke about the shortage of grass. People rarely broke the silence to speak of other things. But the switchboard had an added bonus. It put me in touch with a collection of girls who worked the network throughout New South Wales and Queensland. Our innocent flirtations were a reminder of the sexual excitement waiting beyond my Wilmeringle monastery. The girls were the outside reality. They encouraged me to think about the thrills still to be had following my term of confinement. I didn't need much encouragement. An operator in Moree could be particularly descriptive in her amorous musings, and her wanton words fired my loins every time we spoke. As the nights grew longer, I took to making a few long-distance calls myself. For as Henry Lawson said, they lie, the men who tell us in a loud decisive tone that want is here a stranger and that misery's unknown. Bunny grabbed my arm as I went to the phone. Do you play rugby? He asked. I remembered I'd asked Dougie Orchard the same question, as though it was all important. I've played a bit. Well, rugby could be your ticket to town. They'll love you out here if you can play rugby. Will they? Yeah, country places always hope there's an intelligent player when the new crop of bank johnnies and teachers come in. People don't cotton to male teachers too much, you know. Teachers, writers, actors, bankers. They're all a bunch of poofters until they prove themselves otherwise. Is that so? This was a different assumption than that provided by the telephone operators. Actually, I've been talking to Brawarna and Gadooga about you. Both places would give you a tryout. I haven't thought about it, I answered, though I'd played rugby for half my life and was recognised as a speedy and courageous scrum half and an opportunist with the ball. At college, I'd captained the reserve great side. Strangely, I didn't feel like elaborating on this to Bunny. There's no way to get to games or practices, I shrugged. Well, I'll take care of that. I spoke to the operator in Gadooga for a long time before asking to be passed on to Moree. As luck would have it, the enchanting girl with the earthy cravings, at least over miles of wire, was on duty, and I listened intently with my eyes closed as her silky voice told me exactly how she'd handle me if I ever visited her. I wondered if she looked as good as she sounded. I would have to find out where Moree was on a map. Or I would have to get a car.